Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Men, manly men, manly men,
men.
There's no doubt about it. Masculinity has fallen under criticism. We hear the term toxic masculinity, and that very quickly morphed into, well, all masculinity is toxic, not just some. How did that happen? How does the world get masculinity wrong? And what does Christianity offer as a correction? We're going to be talking about Christianity's response to toxic masculinity. Professor Nancy Piercy joins us. She's professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She is author of several books, including her latest, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Professor Piercy, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
What is the biggest difference, according to the numbers, between men who attend church regularly, Christian men, and nominal Christian men?
Oh, that's a great question, because that's at the heart of the book. What I do in The Toxic War on Masculinity is I acquaint people with what the studies have shown. There have been a lot of sociological studies done on evangelical Christian men. And by the way, some people ask me, why did I focus on evangelicals? Because they're the ones who are being attacked in the media. There's the assumption that Christian men are oppressive, overbearing patriarchs. And so psychologists and sociologists said, where's your evidence? Where's your evidence for those accusations? And they went and did the studies. And what they discovered was stunning. They found out that evangelical Christian men who attend church regularly, in other words, who are committed, authentic in their Christian convictions, test out as the highest of any group in America in terms of being loving husbands and engaged fathers. So some people say, well, of course the wives were not honest. They were being interviewed. Well, no, the wives were interviewed separately. And so the wives actually were reporting that they had the highest levels of satisfaction and happiness with their husbands' levels of love and affection. Evangelical fathers tend to be the most engaged fathers, both in terms of shared activities like church youth group and sports, and in terms of discipline, setting screen time, for example, or enforcing bedtime. Evangelical couples tend to have the lowest level of divorce of any group in America. And then the really surprising factor, they have the lowest rate of domestic violence of any major group in America. And so this is really good news. It's totally contrary to the media narratives. And that's one reason I wanted to get it out. Most of this is hidden away in the academic literature. I had to go digging in academic journals to find it. And so I wanted to acquaint people with this because it's very encouraging. I think we should bring it out both in the church to encourage Christian men and into the public realm, because this is hard empirical data. This is evidence-based data showing that Christian men actually totally shatter the negative stereotypes. Now, you asked about the men who attend church versus the men who are nominal. So that's an important distinction, because the first pushback I get myself is, but haven't we all heard that Christians divorce at the same rate as secular men, the rest of society? And in fact, in my research, I found that that is one of the most widely quoted statistics by Christian leaders. So the researchers went back to the data and they separated out the men who attend church regularly, which they defined as 3 times a month minimum, and the nominal Christian men. So these would be men who identify with some Christian denomination, but don't actually attend church rarely, if at all. And they test out shockingly different. They fit all the toxic stereotypes. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. They are the least involved with their children. They have the highest rate of divorce, higher than secular men. And the real shocker, they have the highest rate of domestic violence of any major group in America. So this is why the numbers get so skewed. If you do a study, or if you're just talking, you know, an article in the newspaper about evangelicals, they're usually putting these two groups together. And of course, they're going to get skewed statistics because they're putting together men who do better than secular men and men who do worse than secular men. So the statistics are always going to be misleading. And so this was an absolutely helpful understanding that churches need to understand that, yes, they should be supporting and encouraging and affirming the men who are doing a good job, that they maybe need to also reach out to the nominal men who are claiming an evangelical identity, but who are actually taking biblical words like headship and submission and infusing them with meanings from the secular world. You know, they're not using the biblical definition. They're infusing those words with secular meaning. And as a result, they end up being even more toxic than secular men.
How does the secular world get masculinity wrong?
Yes, so that was one of my other major questions in writing the book. I was looking at the hostility that has become acceptable to express against men. One article that caught my eye was in the Washington Post, and it was titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And I thought, really, in a respected mainstream publication? A Huffington Post editor tweeted the hashtag, "Kill all men." You can buy t-shirts that say, "So many men, so little ammunition." And even whole books have come out with titles like, "I Hate Men," "No Good Men," and "Are Men Necessary?" Even some men are jumping on the bandwagon and attacking their own sex. A book came out by a male author saying, "Talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer." And in the news not long ago, the director of the movie Avatar was quoted saying, "Testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system." So no wonder that in a recent survey, almost half of American men, 46%, agreed with the statement, "These days, society seems to punish men just for acting like men." And so this is one of the reasons I wrote the book. I wanted to say, you know, how do we get to the bottom of this? You cannot counter a social trend unless you know where it came from. And so a lot of the book is dedicated to tracing step by step how the secular definition for men became so negative to the point where men today feel demoralized and denigrated and demeaned by so much of our culture.
What about Christianity itself curbs the toxic impulses in men?
Well, the gospel, right? To give a one-word answer, the gospel. What I found, let me just give you the findings of these studies. I did research on about a dozen studies. And what they found is when they interviewed Christian couples, I was surprised by this. The main verse that Christian couples quote is Ephesians 5, and especially the part to husbands, because since it's a book on masculinity, especially the part that says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church." And men who were surveyed consistently defined headship in terms of loving service. And they quoted from Ephesians, they quoted from Jesus. Jesus washed the disciples' feet, you know, and then said, "Go and do likewise. This is what a leader does." And they quoted Jesus' examples of how he treated women, that he treated women always with respect. They countered the Jewish culture in several ways. For example, women were not supposed to be spoken to in public, and Jesus did speak to them. The woman at the well, you know, was one of the key examples. She was not only a woman, but a Samaritan. But when the disciples come up, they don't say, "Why are you talking to a Samaritan?" The Jews thought very poorly of the Samaritans. They said, "Why are you talking to a woman?" The text says that that was what really baffled them. So clearly, Jesus' example is what influences a lot of Christian men as well. And so this is what the findings were in terms of just the social science. The most common definition of headship was spiritual leadership. And that was interesting because many people think, Well, if you believe in headship, you mean authority. You mean, you know, I make the final decision. And that's not what most of these couples said. I'm telling you, this was like a dozen different studies. So it's pretty widespread. It cast a wide net. And the most common definition was spiritual leadership, meaning it's my job as a man, as a husband and father, to get my family to church on Sunday, to do Bible reading and devotions at home, to lead prayer at home. But even the more intangible things like make sure that my wife and children are growing spiritually. I'm responsible for their spiritual well-being. So I was stunned. I have to tell you, I didn't expect this. I myself was blown away. I was blown away by how positive these evangelical men were in their description of headship as loving, respectful service.
Let's do a little history. Where did the world's distorted view of masculinity begin historically?
Yes, this is one of the most surprising aspects of the book, because most people probably think it started, say, 1960s, second wave feminism, but it actually goes much further back. It goes back to the Industrial Revolution. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, families worked together on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so husbands and fathers were working side by side with their wives and children all day. And so the expectation on men was much more defined in terms of caretaking and responsibility for the common good of the family. And even authority had a very specific meaning in the colonial era. Authority didn't mean you get to do whatever you want. Authority was very carefully defined as the person responsible for the common good. In other words, you look out for what's good for you, I look out for what's good for me, but who's responsible for the common good of the marriage, of the family, of the church, of the school, society, and so on? And so authority was defined as that's the person who's responsible for the common good. And of course, the colonial era was largely Christian, so it also was infused with biblical concepts of masculinity as well. So how did we lose that? The turning point actually was the Industrial Revolution. It had two effects. On the one hand, it took work out of the home, which meant men had to follow their work out of the home into factories and offices. And for the first time, men were not working with the people they loved and had a moral bond with, you know, the families. Instead, they were working as individuals in competition with other men. And already in the 19th century, you see the literature of the day starts to protest that men were losing that caretaking ethos that they had in the colonial era, that in this industrialized workplace, they were becoming egocentric and greedy and acquisitive and look out for number one and individualistic. And people were protesting that men were losing their godly character already back then. And they were losing their connection with their children. This is when some of the negative views of fatherhood took root. You know, the fathers are just sort of incompetent parents, which is what we see in the media today so often. So on the one hand, this was the first time you start to see negative descriptions of the male character. But at the same time, America was also secularizing. As a public sphere developed, factories and industries and financial institutions and universities and a larger government to deal with it all, people began to say that the public sphere, these large institutions, should be run by scientific principles, by which they meant value-free. In other words, don't bring your personal values into the public realm, which is what we still hear today. And so it was men who were working in that secularized environment and getting that secularized education. And so that was another reason that the biblical ethic was losing its hold on men's hearts. And again, you see this in the literature of the day, that people began to complain that, you know, men were not attending church as often. They were no longer as committed to a biblical ethic. They were buying into a secular ethic. And so if we want to know where it started, it really is the Industrial Revolution. And that maybe gives us some clues to how to fix it. It's how do we get men back engaged in a deep way with their families?
Professor Nancy Piercy is our guest. She's author of several books, including her latest, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. When we come back, when did men come to be considered morally inferior to women?
This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day, you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, Etc.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Christianity's response to toxic masculinity. Professor Nancy Piercy is our guest. Professor Piercy, how did men and when did men come to be considered morally inferior to women?
Well, yes. So this was part of the same story. So as men became more secular in their thinking, their behavior did grow worse. And so historians tell us that in the 19th century, there was a huge increase in drinking and gambling and fighting and crime and prostitution. And that's why you had so many reform movements in the 19th century. This was the century of reform movements. There was such a large interconnected network of reform movements that historians call it the benevolent empire. But they were responding to the fact that men's behavior was growing worse. Sometimes it's easier if you have a single fact to pin it on. So I'll give you one. In 1830, Americans drank three times as much as they do today. So public drunkenness, you know, people falling down drunk in the alleys, was becoming a problem. And men were drinking away their money and leaving their families destitute. And they were coming home drunk and beating their wives and kids. This is all in the literature of the day. They're describing, you know, the negative impact of so much alcoholism. So that's why there was a temperance movement and movements against prostitution and sex trafficking and movements against, obviously, the abolition movement and so on. And that's when the idea sort of took hold then that, well, men are just naturally more prone to sin and vice. Let me explain why that was so new. That had never happened before. All the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, it had been assumed that men are morally superior to women. It was thought that the insight into right and wrong was a rational insight, and men were thought to be more rational, and therefore men were thought to be morally stronger than women. In the 19th century, this completely reversed. Men were now said to be more prone to sin and vice, and women were seen as morally superior. And so, of course, a lot of the tension between the sexes that we see even today took root at that time. I mean, think of the Me Too movement. You know, isn't that women largely saying, men, you've got to shape up. What you're doing is wrong. So a lot of the dynamics we see today actually started in the 19th century.
How has feminism contributed to the problem?
Oh, feminism, I have some pretty awful quotes in my book from feminists. Feminists basically reinforce the notion that men are naturally rude, crude, and lewd, and that women are superior. And also, especially in the second wave feminism, they also started to say that, well, if men are allowed to be immoral, why can't we? They did not want to be considered. In the reform movements of the 19th century, women were seen as, in a sense, the moral guardians of society. And in the early 20th century, women began to say, no, we don't want to be that way anymore. Why should men have all the fun? And that's when you see women start to take up what were till then mostly male vices, drinking and smoking. And at that time, it was a big thing, going to the theater, reading immoral novels. I'm quoting from some of the people at the time. And essentially, instead of holding men in check, which was the idea in the 19th century, women began imitating men. So I think that's what you see today, especially with third wave feminism. It's all about women can be as raunchy as men. And, you know, don't hold us to a higher standard. So I think today, when people hear about the 19th century, when women were held to be morally superior, I get a lot of pushback by people saying, well, actually, women do pretty much the same thing that men do today. At least they try to. The hookup culture, women are just as involved as men are. So a lot of that is a product of third wave feminism.
What has the world's view of masculinity done to fathers and to the common perception of fathers?
Oh, that's a very important question, because the argument I make in the book is the long-term solution to toxic behavior in men is fathers raising their sons, being more intimately involved with their sons. And so it's really serious that in our media today, fathers are regularly mocked and ridiculed and made fun of. We all know that in entertainment, for example, movies and TV, fathers are consistently portrayed as the dimwit dad, the doofus dad, the Homer Simpson type. And so this is one reason that men are avoiding fatherhood. And it's to the point where 40% of children today in America are growing up apart from their natural fathers. And many times they never even know or see their fathers. This is the highest rate of single parenthood in the world. And so it's a serious thing to ask, how can we reconnect fathers to their sons? And once again, it goes back to the Industrial Revolution. When fathers were taken out of the home, they were no longer working side by side with their children all day. You know, they used to teach their kids, their sons, in adult skills and abilities and vocations. Now they were gone all day, and sons were growing up without very much masculine input. That's what people began to say. Even at the time, people began to deplore the fact that fathers were no longer raising their kids. Mothers were stepping in and trying to fill the gap. But the leading psychologist of the 19th century actually wrote, "Never in American history has the boy been so wild," wild because he no longer had father's supervision, "and never before have they been so half orphaned." I like that phrase, half orphaned, because their fathers were no longer raising them. They were being left up to, as he put it, they're left up to female guidance in the home, the church, and the school. And so even today, surveys show that men report a lot of work-family conflict. And when they were asked, what is the main barrier to being more involved with your kids, they still say, it's work, it's my work commitments, just like they did from the Industrial Revolution. And so I do have a whole chapter on practical ways that we might be able to flex the workplace and allow fathers to be more involved with their kids. The pandemic had a very small silver lining, which is that a lot of fathers discovered they liked being more involved with their kids, because when they were working from home, one survey found that 65% of fathers say they do not want to go back to work full time because they want to be with their kids. Or the New York Times had an article, I love this title. It said, during the pandemic, fathers got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that. So not only do we have to recognize what it is that made our culture denigrate fathers, but how can we solve that? And so I do give practical solutions.
What happens when men absorb the world's view of masculinity?
Well, those are the nominal Christian men that we started out with the first question. So a lot of people want to say that abusive men who are Christian, it's their theology that's driving it. It's because they read the Bible and it says, you know, the husband and father should be the head of the home. So theology is to blame. Well, it turns out that's not true. As I said, I looked at a dozen studies of evangelical men, most of whom do accept the notion of male headship, and they test out as the most loving husbands and fathers of any group in America. So clearly the theology is not what's causing it. Instead, what's causing it is that these nominal Christian men are not tied into the church enough to have a biblical view of authority and headship. And so instead, what they're doing is they're taking the secular view of masculinity and sort of baptizing it with Christian language. And that's why they end up actually testing out as worse than secular men. I have had people say, well, worse? Why would they be worse? Because secular men don't have the sort of religious justification. It's the men who are nominal Christians who feel like, oh, well, I have religious justification, you know, a religious sanction for acting like a tyrant in my home. So that's why they test out worse. But it's not because of the theology. I found that that's an important point to make because I'm getting pushback even from some Christians who say, well, it's the theology itself that's at fault. Well, clearly not. I mean, the facts show otherwise. It is that these men, nominal men, are taking in a secular definition of authority and headship. And that is what's really causing it.
Professor Nancy Piercy is our guest. We're talking about Christianity's response to toxic masculinity. We'll get her assessment of a movement called Muscular Christianity next.
Register today. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport in Erlanger, Kentucky. The conference includes visits to the Ark Encounter and Creation Museum. Online registration is open now with early bird pricing at lutheransforlife.org/conference. Lutherans for Life, equipping Lutherans and their neighbors to be gospel-motivated voices for life. lutheransforlife.org.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press is a family-run publisher of classical Christian education materials for homeschools and private schools. Every page of the Memoria Press curriculum leads students to a mastery of content, an understanding of the classical heritage of the Christian West, and an appreciation of truth, goodness, and beauty. If you're interested in learning more, visit memoriapress.com and use the coupon code LPR23. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. memoriapress.com.
What's a man now? What's a man mean? Is he rough or is he rugged? Is he cultural and clean?
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Professor Nancy Piercy is our guest. She's author of several books, including her latest, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. We're discussing Christianity's response to toxic masculinity. So, Professor Piercy, what is your assessment of this Victorian-era movement called Muscular Christianity?
Yeah, so after the Industrial Revolution, we're back to that term again, men were no longer working on the farm, working outdoors. They were sitting in an office in a cubicle, and people began to feel that they had lost something in their masculinity in an urban environment where, you know, they did nothing more rigorous than pencil pushing. People began to be concerned. In fact, a new word entered the English vocabulary. It was over-civilized. People began to fear that men had become over-civilized, soft and effeminate, to use their language. And the church was concerned too. And many people began to say, people like Spurgeon, I have a wonderful quote from Spurgeon where he says, people tend to think that religion itself is emasculating, that religion makes men soft and effeminate. And so there was a movement to make Christianity focus more on the masculine virtues. Can we focus more on what is uniquely masculine? Because by far the most of the commandments in scripture are to both sexes. But let's face it, men and women are different. And that's how God made them. You know, just biologically speaking, men are bigger, stronger, faster. And that's why in most cultures, men are protectors and providers. So churches, they dubbed it muscular Christianity. This is when churches began to have sports leagues. That had not been done before. Basketball leagues and soccer leagues to help men, especially men. Women and children are involved now too, of course, but it started out as especially a way of helping people to see that Christianity also values the distinctively masculine traits and virtues, that you don't have to leave your masculinity at the door. Part of the problem is that, well, really, ever since the early church, there have been more women than men in the church. Historical records show that it was that way right from the beginning, but it became even more so in America after the First and Second Great Awakenings, because the awakenings attracted more women than men. And the reason for that is they were not really presenting an apologetic against secularism and atheism, because there were not very many atheists in American society at the time. They were mostly nominal Christians, lukewarm Christians. And so the goal of the revivalists was to spark, give new life to people who were nominal. And so by definition, almost, they tended to focus on an intense emotional conversion experience. And since women were thought to be more emotional, that seemed to put religion into the domain of women. So muscular Christianity said, no, no, we have got to counter that notion. We have to counter the notion that religion is for women and children. And they did have some effect, muscular Christianity. They did have some impact on attracting more men to the church. But today, the average American congregation is still 60% women, 40% men. And so I would say we still have a problem with learning how to attract men to church and how to really value and support and affirm the specifically male virtues.
How do we bring fathers back?
Yeah, like I said, I have a whole chapter on practical examples, because you can't just throw this out and say, well, you know, men have been disconnected from their families from the time of the Industrial Revolution. And they're like, whoa, what do we do about that? And so I give lots of examples of men who were able to flex their work 2 days a week from home, for example, or in some cases, even start a home business, or even just leave work 2 days a week early. One of my students was a husband, father who left work a couple of days early to coach his son's basketball and soccer teams. His boss accused him of coasting, but he said, it did not hurt my career. When my boys got older, they said, we want to be a dad like you, which of course is much better than any workplace accolades. But I'll give you one example. Sometimes it's easier to have one single example. One of my students was married to an IT professional. And during the pandemic, of course, he worked from home. And I interviewed him and he said, being home, I didn't lose a beat in terms of my work. He said, but I was able to be more involved in the homeschooling of our children. I decided I would be the one to make lunch every day. I was able to take my kids to soccer and choir practice. And he said, I'm never going back to a cubicle. And because he was picking up more of the family responsibilities, his wife was able to start a part-time business. She's a singer, and she started a voice studio. So the entire family benefited from the added income. But the final kicker was, her husband said to me, the time that I used to spend commuting to work, I now spend praying with my wife every morning. So at this point, it's just anecdotes like that to help encourage men to think of ways that they might be able even in an industrial workplace, can we flex the workforce a little bit? Oh, and by the way, I also quoted CEOs. We want to make sure we present this as something that's good for families, but also good for business. I quoted CEOs who said, we were really leery about letting people work from home because, of course, we thought they would slough off, they wouldn't work. During the pandemic, that fear was totally exploded. We did not experience any loss in productivity. And if anything, we got more work because, you know, people weren't wasting time on the freeway, fighting traffic, and so on. So we have to show, I actually quoted CEOs who said, people, both men and women, who are better parents, if you give them time to be better parents, they are more productive when they're at work. So giving men the chance to be better parents makes them better workers.
What is the Christian response to toxic masculinity's excesses?
Well, I think we just keep coming back to what does Scripture say? I'll give you an interesting sociological study, and it was not a Christian study, but a sociologist, he's well known in his field, so he's invited to speak all around the world. And so he came up with this ingenious experiment. He asked young men two questions. First, he said, what does it mean to be a good man? And young men had no problem answering that. They said that means things like honor, duty, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, be a protector, be a provider, be responsible. And the sociologist would say, where did you learn that? And they say, well, it's just in the air we breathe. Or if they were in a Western country, they would say, it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Then the sociologist would ask a follow-up question. He'd say, what does it mean if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young man would say, no, it's completely different. That means be tough, be strong, never show weak costs, suck it up, be competitive, get rich, I'm using their language, but incorporates many of the traits that people today consider toxic, especially if it gets separated from the moral vision of the good man. It can easily slide into things like entitlement and dominance and control. And so what this means is that, well, first of all, men do not respond well to being called toxic, right? Nobody would. So this suggests a different strategy that we can use. Instead of accusing men of being toxic, we can try to tap into their innate knowledge of what it means to be the good man. And this is universal. Like I said, the sociologist speaks in countries around the world, from Brazil to Sweden to Australia. All men know what it means to be a good man. They're made in God's image, and they're encoded with God's software for being a good man. And so what it means is that we can tap into, encourage, and support their innate knowledge of what it means to be a good man. And it also means, of course, that when we ask them to live up to a biblical moral ethic on masculinity, we're not imposing something that's alien, you know, something that's counter to their nature. We are asking them to live up to what they already know is really the good man.
Professor Nancy Piercy is professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, author of several books, including her latest, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Professor Piercy, thank you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Issues Etc. has been brought to you in part this week by LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Lutheran Church Missouri Synod chaplains deliver word and sacrament ministry to our military personnel and their families. Find out about their service at lcms.org/armedforces, lcms.org/armedforces. Next week on Issues Etc., we'll talk to Michael Knowles about reconsidering political correctness. We'll continue our series on the proper distinction between law and gospel with Pastor Will Whedon, and we'll find out what real science is from Jay Sonstrom. I'm Todd Wilkin. Go to church Sunday. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.